Sign up today for the Film Comment Letter. It's a free weekly digital newsletter featuring original film criticism and writing by Film Comment's editors and brilliant contributors.
The letter delivers exclusive features, reviews, interviews, streaming picks, news, and more directly to subscribers' inboxes before they're published on filmcomment.com the following Monday.
Sign up today at filmcomment.com.
Welcome to the Film Comment Podcast. I'm Clinton Crute, the co-editor of Film Comment. In his new book, The Rebels Clinic, The Revolutionary Lives of Frantz Fanon, Adam Schatz writes that the American poet Amiri Baraka described James Baldwin, who was born a year before Fanon, as God's black revolutionary mouth. What Baldwin was for America, Fanon was for the world, especially the insurgent Third World, those subjects of European empires who had been denied what Edward Said called the permission to narrate. The biography explores in lucid detail the complex life and thought of the Martinican psychiatrist and anti-colonial theorist, whose life was tragically cut short by leukemia in 1961. Fanon's epical books, Black Skin, White Mask, and The Wretched of the Earth, have long been a source of inspiration for politically minded filmmakers, including Med Hondo, Claire Denis, and many others. Devika and I invited Adam on the podcast to talk about Fanon's interest in cinema, filmmakers who've engaged the theorist's work, and what exactly makes a movie Fanonian. In addition to films by Hondo and Denis, we talked about Ivan Dixon's The Spook Who Sat by the Door, Antonioni's The Passenger, Pontecorvo's The Battle of Algiers, and more. We hope you enjoy the conversation.
Adam, it is such a pleasure to have you on the Film Comment podcast. This episode has been long in the works since I attended your talk at NYU with Fred Moten about your new book, The Rebels Clinic, a biography of Fanon. And I know you've been going all over with this book, and we're really glad that we've been able to catch you for a second for the Film Comment podcast.
Thanks so much. Real pleasure.
And if you could, in brief, introduce yourself to our listeners. This is something we ask all our guests to do, and it is often actually an interesting exercise.
Sure, I can do that. I'm a writer and a journalist. My title is U.S. editor of the London Review of Books. I've been with the LRB since 2007, but I also write for other places, particularly the New York Review of Books. And I'm also a real cinephile. And I've been reading Film Comment for, God, well over 20 years. And I occasionally write on film. I a few years ago, I did a long piece about Jean-Pierre Melville, one of my favorite filmmakers. So it's very cool to be on this podcast in particular.
Well, we're very happy to have you. On that note, maybe you could talk a little bit about how you came to write this book based on, did this grow out of research that you had already been doing? Where did your interest in and enthusiasm for the subject come from?
You know, the strange thing is that when I look at the earliest interviews that I did for this book, they were conducted in 2001. So well over 20 years ago and long before I even had the idea of pursuing a long book project on Frantz Fanon. There were interviews that I conducted in Paris with people who had known Fanon when they were in Algeria and Tunisia. And the reason I interviewed them really had nothing to do with Fanon. It was really about the memory of the war in Algeria, because I was researching a piece about the French debate on torture in the early aughts. But since they knew Fanon, and since I had had an interest in Fanon since I was really in my teens and early 20s, I ended up asking them questions, and their answers ended up being quite useful later on when I decided to do this book. The book itself, I guess, grew out of a piece that I published in the LRB in 2017 that was a biographical essay inspired by the publication of Fanon's psychiatric writings, a book called Writings on Freedom and Alienation. I reviewed it when it was published in French, and the book was such an extraordinary compendium of his writings on medicine, also his youthful plays. And it gave a different and much more intimate picture of Fanon as a doctor. And after I wrote that piece, a friend of mine, Pankaj Mishra, said, "I think there might be a book here for you." And the more I thought about it, the more I decided, well, he's right. But my interest in Fanon really goes back to the mid-90s when I was reading him in college and when I began reporting on Algeria, but also parts of the Middle East, notably Palestine. I kept running into him in various guises and just grasped how crucial and significant a figure he was. And what's more, I was very affected by his writing, which I read for the first time in a French class at Columbia University in, I think, 1991. So, that's it. I guess a lot of roads led to him. And so it sounds almost inevitable, but it wasn't.
I mean, in the book, you actually go even farther back. You say that you first saw Fanon on the cover of your father's copy of Black Skin, White Masks. So I'm assuming that was even before college, you were sort of familiar with his work.
Oh, absolutely. You know, my dad had a nice little collection of radical books, many of them published by Grove Press, books by Malcolm X and Isaac Deutscher and Fanon. And yes, I remember seeing the photo of him on the jacket of Black Skin, White Masks, the original English translation. And the story that this, the story recounted on the jacket of this this West Indian psychiatrist who fought for France in World War II and then fought against France with the FLN during the war, the Algerian War, it just intrigued me. It made me want to know more about him. I only learned more a few years later, but when I began reading him, I remembered that book jacket, yes. Mm-hmm.
So I remember at the talk you did at NYU, you talked a little bit about why did you write a book on Fanon, which is a question you're maybe likely to be asked. And you said, I don't want to overly simplify what you said, but you did make connections between, first of all, Fanon's writing in the anti-colonial struggle and your experience as a Jewish person with Jewish ancestors, and also Fanon's embrace, but his embrace of the outsider position in a way, or how he really chose that as his position in life. He was in Algeria, not a Muslim. He was in France as a man from the West Indies. I was wondering if you could get into that a little bit. What sort of resonances have you found?
Sure, that's true. And you know, I should just say at the outset that in no way today in 2024 do I regard myself as an outsider. And some, in fact, would look at me and say, "Hey, this guy's an insider. He's part of the journalistic establishment. He's a white dude, et cetera, et cetera. How can he claim to have I'm not claiming outsider status. I just want to be clear on that."
I meant more that you're writing about someone who you're not connected to via ethnicity or nationality in that sense.
Sure. But then again, when you think about it, and based on what you just said about Fanon, that's not un-Fanonian, is it? I mean,
exactly.
Fanon was not someone who stayed in his own lane, and that's been true actually of my work. I mean, I may, as you put it, have Jewish ancestors, including my parents, rather close ancestors, but
progenitors even.
Right, but as a writer, I have not focused on one. I haven't focused on topics that pertain to Jewish concerns or what would stereotypically be understood as Jewish concerns. And what's more, you know, my understanding of Jewish history and of Jews in the world reflects an outlook that is closer to that of someone like Isaac Deutscher, or let's say a left-wing universalist tradition, rather than one that sees Jews as, you know, uniquely victimized, or that, for example, would draw upon Holocaust memory to justify, you know, the obscene destruction that we're seeing in the Gaza Strip right now. But it is true that one of the reasons I felt a visceral kind of identification with Fanon's writing when I first read it is that there is a scene in Black Skin, White Masks that resonated with my own experience. And that scene, it's a famous scene. It's sometimes described as the primal scene in Fanon's understanding of racism. And it involves an incident that occurred on a train in France not long after the Second World War, in which Fanon, you know, won a Croix de Guerre, fought very honorably, valiantly, had a shrapnel wound. And here he is, this war veteran, this man who has bled for France. And he's on a train, and this little white boy looks at him and says, "Tiens, maman, un nègre." And he's this little boy's mother, you know, basically tells him to shut up, and that, you know, this black man is in fact very handsome. And the thought that goes through Fanon's mind at that point is, you know, I don't know, can I swear on this program? I mean,
absolutely.
I mean, basically, like, you know, the handsome black man tells you to fuck off. And what happens in that scene, as recounted by Fanon in Black Skin, White Masks, is that under the gaze of this white boy, this little white boy who has somehow, in spite of his youth, is already an expert in racial identification, Fanon feels paralyzed, and he starts to look at himself as though he were a stranger to himself. He looks at himself as an object, and then he starts to feel violent, you know, as that anecdote implies. And, you know, when I was a kid, I did experience a particularly bad and ugly series of anti-Semitic encounters with kids whom I had known, kids whom I thought of as my friends. The first time that I realized that there was any connection made in the, let's say, the anti-Semitic imaginary between Jews and money was when these kids started throwing change on the floor at me and called me a dirty Jew and said how much I love money. I didn't know. I was ignorant of this stuff. And, you know, Fanon was someone who had grown up as a West Indian of color, thinking of himself as a Frenchman. He didn't think of himself as black. Black people were the tirailleurs sénégalais, the African riflemen. So suddenly, one, he realizes that he's black in the eyes of this kid. Two, he realizes that he's connected with all sorts of bad things, you know, cannibalism, irrationality, violence, whatever. So, you know, when I read that scene, I thought, wow, I think I understand what's going on there. And I also understand the violent reaction. Now, in Black Skin, White Masks, Fanon is not making an argument about armed struggle. He's not making an argument about the relationship between violence and recognition, which he makes later on in The Wretched of the Earth. But it's still there. And so it was just that essay just had such an impact on me. And I kept going back to it. And perhaps that those were the first seeds of my preoccupation with Fanon.
Well, speaking of sort of tracing psychologies and understanding seeds of behaviors, we wanted to ask about, we are a cinema podcast, and we wanted to ask you about Fanon's interest in cinema. I'm not sure. It's not something that comes up, but I know that at one point you mentioned that he screened films and put on concerts for his patients in Algeria when he was beginning to kind of understand how to treat these patients in an effective way. Were you privy to his own, did you discover anything about his own understanding of cinema or his own interest in it?
Well, as it happens, I am friendly with an Algerian woman, a journalist, my generation, which means, you know, early 50s, whose father was a soldier in the Algerian National Liberation Army, and Fanon treated him in Tunisia. And he was very generous to this man because this man did not want to return to the front. And Fanon's role was to prepare these soldiers to go back. And he ended up not going back. I think he did other kinds of work. And Fanon was very kind to him. He gave him money to go see movies. And according to my friend, the recommendations that he gave him were mostly for Nouvelle Vague films. But this, her father was an illiterate guy from the countryside who had zero interest in new wave films and ended up going to see Westerns. And Fanon knew that he was not going to see the films that he recommended to him, but was quite tolerant. Fanon was interested in American films about race, the so-called liberal race films. He refers in passing to them in Black Skin, White Masks. I mean, he was interested in them as symptoms of a culture. And he drew upon them in passing. I think he talks about Home of the Brave at one point. And there is also an anecdote in the memoirs of Marie-Jeanne Manoualon, his secretary in Tunis, who became a confidant of mine in her last years before she died. And Marie-Jeanne went to see Hiroshima Mon Amour with Fanon. And Fanon apparently loved the film.
That tracks, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we'll remember there's also, you know, Hiroshima Mon Amour, as you know, turns around this, these traumatic memories of the Emmanuel Riva character of being forcibly shaved, having her head shaved during the liberation because of a love affair she had with a German soldier. And Marie-Jeanne, who had been reading psychoanalytic writings, particularly Freud, under Fanon's tutelage, likened aspects of the film to psychoanalysis. And Fanon was very happy about this because he thought, oh, wow, this woman, my secretary, my pupil, is getting it. Fanon was not what you would call he was not a precocious feminist. He certainly had
as you note.
No, he was not. I mean, he clearly had a regard for Marie-Jeanne. They were close, and so they did discuss this film. And I think also another aspect of the film that appealed to him, and obviously this is not an aesthetic dimension of René's cinema or Duras's screenplay, was the emphasis on parallel loves, these contingent loves, these passing loves that emerge and that are often outside the boundaries of a person's primary relationship. And Fanon thought that these kinds of love affairs, which Sartre and Beauvoir had allowed themselves in their own relationship, were a vital kind of freedom, and that monogamy was essentially a prison that prevented each member of the couple from experiencing freedom.
Well, his affection for the new wave makes sense.
Yes.
Given that.
Yes.
Yeah.
But did he see Godard films? I mean, he died in 61. He could have seen Breathless, but that's about it. I mean, Le Petit Soldat came out in what, 1960, 61?
60, right?
Yeah, but it was banned. So it's unlikely. And also, Le Petit Soldat is about a member of the OAS. It's a member of the right-wing paramilitaries. So who knows? It's a fascinating thing to ponder.
Its release was delayed until 1963. So then
obviously he couldn't have.
Yeah. I was very excited for the opportunity to discuss Fanon and cinema with you because, you say in the book that he wrote plays and he had these artistic inclinations, but cinema seems like such a Fanonian medium in any way, like the medium of the collective unconscious. And also, a medium that can represent violence in maybe a transformative way. And I know that when we reached out to you and, I was thinking we'd talk about the famous Fanon films, the documentaries, you know, Goran Olsen's Concerning Violence and, you know, the documentary, Isaac Julian's documentary. But you actually wanted to talk about sort of Fanonian films more so than films about Fanon. And I was wondering if you could, you know, dig into that a little bit. What to you is a Fanonian film? I know that's a very broad question, but how have you seen that tendency maybe manifest in cinema?
Well, I should say, first of all, that we can certainly talk about the films about Fanon. I don't think that they're the most interesting films to think about in relation to Fanon's work. I mean, they're certainly useful if you want to think about Fanon. But I'm more interested in, I guess, two kinds of films that touch in some way upon Fanon's work. And I think, you know, I can describe two. I mean, the first would be a film that really is Fanonian in the sense that it is clearly drawing upon Fanon's work, Fanon's vision in some way. And I would include films like The Battle of Algiers, which makes no explicit reference to Fanon, but is clearly steeped in his work, not just in his work, but in specific chapters of his work. And we know that Giulio Pontecorvo was a passionate reader of Fanon.
And a producer of the film was a comrade of Fanon in the FLN, sorry, is that?
No, he was a member of the FLN, certainly. He was one of the leaders of the Kasbah, Yasef Saadi. He was a co-producer of the film, and he also helped to write the film, and he played himself in the film. I mean, it's kind of an incredible story, and he's fantastic in it. I don't think that Yasef Saadi ever knew Fanon, though. Fanon, remember, was operating in Blida, not in Algiers. And although Blida is close to Algiers, it wasn't the same wilaya, and it's highly unlikely that they met. So that's one. I mean, that's one example. Another example would be La Noire Deux, the Black Girl by Ousmane Sembene, another film that is clearly very influenced by a reading of Fanon's work. And you know, we can talk about, let's say, the function of the mask in Black Girl, because it's very indebted to Fanon's reading of how traditional culture is transformed under the impact of struggle. Then, so those are Fanonian films, and there are others. We could certainly add others to the list. But then you have films that I would call, you could call them Fanonist films, or films that are part of a kind of Fanonian imaginary. And so, in other words, these are films that are not necessarily influenced by a reading of Fanon. The directors may not have known anything about Fanon, and yet, you know, Fanonism was part of, you know, l'air du temps, was part of the spirit of the times. And so let's say a film like The Spook Who Sat by the Door by Ivan Dixon, or Jules Dassin's film Uptight, another very Fanonian film, but not a film that, you know, I doubt Dassin was reading Fanon. And there are many, many other examples of this. I mean, I would add, by the way, I mean, Devika, you made a great point about why cinema lends itself to Fanonian explorations, the way in which it lends itself to the study of violence or the unconscious and so on. But I would add something else that I think is really crucial. It's that film allows you, as few other mediums do, to visualize the masses, right? I mean, I think that's key, because the masses are the subject of history in Fanon.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, I mean, the Battle of Algiers is kind of a striking example of that, really visualizing the masses. I want to dig into all of these films, but I actually wanted to start with a film you talk a little bit in detail about in the book, and that's Shoah. and Claude Lanzmann's affinity for Fanon, which I think is really interesting because one of the points you make in the book is how popular Fanon has become over the years and how he has been appropriated by so many different causes. And I found the Lanzmann example really interesting because it seems also archetypal in a certain way of the misreadings of Fanon's writings on violence, but also maybe not as much as misreadings, but like not confronting the ambivalence in his writings. But so maybe you could start, maybe just start by talking about Lanzmann. Yeah,
I think that's true. But I think that, you know, Lanzmann's misreading or his, let's say, his embrace of the kind of martial aspect of Fanon, the emphasis on the therapeutic nature of violence, the regenerative potential of violence, is something he actually shares with a lot of the third world insurgents who read Fanon in the late 60s. It's just that with Lanzmann, it's put to different ends. It's put to the end of the creation of a Jewish state in Palestine, you know, and to the defense of the Israeli army. I mean, you know, as you know, Claude Lanzmann will eventually, long after Shoah, make a 4-hour documentary celebrating the Israeli armed forces called Sahal. So, you know, I think that, you know, with Lanzmann, you know, the attraction to Fanon is also biographical because Lanzmann, meets with Fanon in Tunis in the late 1950s, early 60s, a year or so before Fanon dies, and he finds Fanon in this sort of miserable state. You know, Fanon is already showing symptoms of leukemia. I can't recall if he had been diagnosed at that point, but he was visiting a man who was clearly not well, and Fanon had acquired a certain aura in radical circles. He was beginning to publish in the journal that Lanzmann helped to edit, Les Temps Modernes. And Lanzmann was someone who had grown up with this burning sense of injustice because of the persecution of Jews in France. And he himself had taken up arms when he was a teenager. So he shared with Fanon an experience of racism, in this case, anti-Semitism, and also an experience of going into battle. Fanon had joined the Free French Forces when he was 19 years old. He tried to do it when he was 17, failed, and finally succeeded at 19. And Lanzmann joined the resistance and was apparently pretty heroic. But, you know, Lanzmann had gone through, Lanzmann ended up rallying to the left. He became a fellow traveler with the Communist Party. He might have been a member, I'm not sure. And he was electrified by his encounter with Fanon. And, you know, it's important to recall, too, that, you know, Fanon had, after all, written about anti-Semitism in Black Skin, White Masks, and quoted a professor of his at the Lycée in Fort-de-France, Martinique, that, you know, watch out. If you hear someone talking about the Jews, they're probably talking about you as well. And he writes that the Negrophobe is almost inevitably an anti-Semite as well. So he drew these links between anti-Black racism and anti-Semitism. And I think that argument probably made an impression on, you know, the young Claude Lanzmann. But of course, Claude Lanzmann eventually breaks with the Communist Party and eventually the left altogether. And after the 1967 war, in fact, already before the 67 war, beginning really in the late 50s, early 60s, develops this very intense identification with Israel and essentially transfers his passions for communism onto the Jewish state, and which he embraces just as unconditionally and uncritically as he did the Soviet Union. But the interest in Fanon remains. It's just that his Fanonism becomes a defense of, you know, of Jewish military, Israeli Zionist military might. Somehow, I mean, in other words, in his vision, these Israeli soldiers are overcoming the weakness and humiliation of the shtetl, of the diaspora, of the exile, and remaking themselves as men. Now, I'm not defending the argument, and obviously my views on Israel-Palestine could not be more different from Lanzmann's, but the logic is not dissimilar. It is an emphasis on the relationship between violence and psychological regeneration.
I mean, it's so interesting how he's using, yeah, you're using the same tools.
Same tools. And he's not the only one. I mean, I think that, you know, Fanon has had an enormous influence on revolutionary insurgent circles and, you know, what we used to call the Third World, some of us still do, and also on the Palestinian struggle. I mean, in the early 1960s, he was translated in Beirut, and people like Abu Iyad, Saleh Khalef, one of the leaders of Fatah, read him. He was read in the training camps of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. And in a sense, Fanon, after his death, was Palestinized. But there were always people in kind of Zionist circles who continued to read Fanon and in a manner of speaking considered him one of their own. I doubt very much that Fanon would have supported Israel in its various wars against the Palestinian people. I think it's very hard to imagine. But precisely because he said nothing about it. Right, he never wrote about the Palestinians. He died in 61. I mean, so the time period has a lot to do with it. He never wrote about them. He never actually really wrote about Israel. As a result, in that ambiguity, a lot of interpretations about Fanon in the Middle East have flourished.
I think you mentioned he wrote about them twice or something in passing in a journal entry, right?
Yeah, it's related to the reparations of the German government for the Holocaust, and he suggests at one point that perhaps this might provide a model for colonized people who have suffered similar crimes, you know. But it's not in relation to the sort of the settler colonial dynamic of that struggle. Now Lanzmann also applies a Fanonian logic to the revolts of Jewish victims of the Holocaust in the concentration camps. I mean, he made a film called Sobibor, for example. And you know, he's not the only person who student of the Holocaust who have found resonant analogies in Fanon. Another is the writer Jean Améry, who his real name was Hans Meyer. He was an Austrian who took part in the resistance and in the late 1960s, again in L'État Moderne, published a very interesting piece in which he drew upon Fanon and said that Fanon appeared to be describing his own experience in the camps. And he wrote furthermore that for the oppressed, whether they're victims of colonialism or whether they're in a death camp, violence becomes an affirmation of humanity.
Mm-hmm. We wanted to talk a little bit about another film that you mentioned, The Spook Who Sat by the Door, Ivan Dixon's 1973 kind of mid-budget thriller, but also just very, I think it was suppressed, right?
It was.
Because it was so fiery and revolutionary. And I'm interested to hear your thoughts on that film and how you read it kind of through a Fanonian lens.
And I'm especially interested, just to follow up on that, on the idea of Fanon as this as someone who felt betrayed by France and betrayed France, this kind of traitorous
aspect
of his revolutionary zeal.
Right, because the central character in The Spy Who Sat by the Door is this CIA agent who is trained by the CIA, but then uses those same skills against the government.
I think he joins the CIA precisely to learn those skills so that he can foment a revolution in Chicago.
He's playing the long game.
He is. I mean, you know, there are many Fanonian elements. Another one is the idea of the mask. I mean, what is this man wearing but a mask? I mean, he's nimbly code switching and playing the quote unquote Uncle Tom.
His name, his code name in the film, I think his character's is Uncle Tom. Yeah.
Yeah. Precisely so that he can acquire the skills and know-how that will allow him to lead a revolution. I mean, it's a wacky film. It's, you know, every single character in it is a stereotype, black or white. And I mean, it's kind, in some ways, it's a kind of proto blaxploitation film. It's a revolutionary blaxploitation film, not unlike Melvin Van Peebles' Apocal, and, you know, arguably
sweet,
much more
sick.
Exactly. Sweet Sweetback's badass song.
There's a moment in the film when the character says something like, we're a colony, we need to be a nation, where there's this analysis of their situation.
Well, remember, this is a period in American history when the idea of internal colonialism or internal colonization was being explored by a lot of sociologists. The first person, I think, to propose the term was a radical white sociologist, radical Jewish sociologist, in a journal article in the late 1960s, and it was taken up by many others, and it became part of the lingo. I think it's quite likely that people in the, you know, Black Panther milieus were already using it. I don't want to suggest that this white sociologist invented it, because I think it was, again, part of the mood of the times. But the idea that Black people living in poor urban areas and, you know, who are suffering from, you know, from poverty, discrimination, lack of access to good jobs and healthcare, that they were, in a sense, America's colonized, and that they had to join together in resistance of some kind, even violence, to forge a new future for themselves. This was certainly a project of a lot of the Black Power organizations, of the Panthers. The Panthers were very interested in Fanon's work for a number of reasons. It wasn't primarily the cult of violence, in fact. That's a misunderstanding that's been widely propagated. It's actually, I mean, and it goes along with this, I think, the general mystification of the Panthers, to which, of course, they also contributed by going around in leather jackets and holding arms and carrying arms. But the fact is, the Panthers were drawn to Fanon in large part because he wrote about the impact of colonialism on the mental health of African Americans, and because he criticized medical malpractice of racist American doctors. I mean, if you have experienced, or if your people have experienced something like the Tuskegee experiments, or let's say, or forced sterilization, or the experience of going to a doctor and being, you know, deeply mistreated or condescended to, or even molested, you're not going to have a difficult time understanding Fanon's essay, Colonialism and Medicine in a Dying Colonialism. It's like reading your own memoir in a way. And so the Panthers were assigning Fanon's works, including his medical writings. I mean, to the extent that they were available at the time, they were only a few pieces that were available. They were assigning them to the doctors and social workers that they hired for their healthcare clinics.
Well, it's interesting that the film focuses so much more on the violent revolutionary aspect, I mean, it's not interesting. It's obvious. It's obviously like, you know, this is an entertainment. Yeah, they want the explosions.
Why wouldn't they?
It's pretty cool, you know.
But also,
a lot of cars, a lot of trucks blow up.
Of course, and it's also like it's also the pleasure,
right?
That the audience will get from seeing the underdog win, you know, and Fanon, you know, as a he wasn't a psychoanalyst, but he was a psychiatrist with a strong interest in psychoanalysis. But as a psychiatrist, he was very alive to the to the desires of oppressed people for, you know, fighting back, for even for revenge. He writes in The Wretched of the Earth that the colonized person is a persecuted man who dreams constantly of becoming the persecutor. He also writes, and I think this is a line that in a sense speaks to the experience of film, from 9 to 6 or from 10 to 5 every night, the colonized person is revolting against colonialism. In other words, in his or her dreams, and cinema is so much about the dream life. So why wouldn't radically inclined filmmakers, especially Black filmmakers, put these visions of, you know, divine justice on the screen? And of course, they're also drawing upon American traditions, like, you know, above all the Western, you know, when they make these films. I just want to make one more point about the spook who sat by the door. So who are the people who are revolting in Chicago in this film? They're the poor, they're the criminal, they're the lumpen proletariat. And remember that, you know, one of the reasons that Fanon appealed to the Black Power movement is that he wasn't writing about working class revolts. He was writing about the revolt of peasants and also urban lumpen proletariat elements.
Right.
And that's what you see on the screen in The Spook Who Sat by the Door.
Right. I think the lead character's love interest at one point is like pushes back and says, these people, we can't join this, that they're attacking everything, all the work that we've done to like claw our way up to where we are. Yeah, I think that this is speaks to that as well.
I wanted to talk about a film that we actually discussed a little bit recently on the podcast, which is Solelo by Med Hondo. There was a retrospective of Med Hondo's. To me, in some ways, that is the Fanonian film because of Hondo's analysis of violence, of displacement and immigration, of psychological breakdown. You know, this kind of the combination of psychological breakdown and like material breakdown, because the film very realistically depicts the conditions of West Indian migrants, African migrants, immigrants in France.
It even includes a scene that sort of mirrors that foundational scene you were describing on the train, right? I mean, where the lead character arrives and then is forced to confront the prejudices of the world he's now exists in.
There are so many Fanonian elements in Solelo, which I think is an extraordinary film that should be much better known. I love this film. But before we even get to Solelo, I mean, I think we need to talk about who Med Hondo was, because he's such a fascinating figure for French cinema, radical French cinema too. And, you know, I'll tell you, it's a very, very strange story. Med Hondo would later become the voice of Eddie Murphy in French cinema.
We actually we did a podcast focused on Med Hondo two episodes ago, and we had a scholar, Aboubakar Sanogo, on who explained this incredible thing about his voice acting and how that was how he made his money and was able to fund a lot of his work. But he's known throughout France as the voice of not only Eddie Murphy, but I think like any number of other popular actors and characters.
To me, the most shocking revelation from that podcast was that Med Hondo voiced Ben Kingsley
in Gandhi.
In Gandhi. The Oscar-winning movie Gandhi. That was, you know, I'm still unpacking all the layers of that revelation.
That is hilarious. Well, Med Hondo, you know, made a kind of a, you know, very audacious cameo in Jean-Luc Godard's Masculine Feminine on the train. And it's a scene where he's observed by Jean-Pierre Léaud and a friend of his, and Med Hondo is talking to a white woman he's with, and delivering this profane monologue about Bessie Smith and Charlie Parker and what that music really expresses. And it's a very incendiary monologue. As it happens, that monologue is lifted from Leroy Jones's play Dutchman, word for word. It's not written by Godard. And Med Hondo had premiered that work in Paris. Now, Soleil, I think, you know, is rich in Fanonian meanings. For example, we see the lead character, who is an immigrant laborer with a white woman on the street. And we see the kind of the horrified reactions of pedestrians passing by. Those weren't made up. They were actually standing, that's documentary. They stood on the street and Med Hondo filmed them. So we see the very vulnerable relationship of a black man with a white woman and the fury and the contempt that merely the spectacle gives rise to in the French city. And I think it's a scene that makes me think actually of Fanon's experiences in Lyon with his with the woman who would become his wife, Marie-Joseph Dublé or Josie. They were pulled aside by the police, and he was accused of quote unquote white slavery. And the kind of charged and complex relationship between a black man and a white woman is, of course, the subject of one of the chapters of Black Skin, White Masks. As Devika, as you were pointing out, this is a film that is also very much preoccupied with the psychological impact of racism on colonized subjects who come to the metropole. And to me, the experience that it depicts, and there are all manner of incidents in the film, is very reminiscent of Fanon's essay, The North African Syndrome. It's the second essay that Fanon published. He published it in a journal called Esprit in 1951, 1952. And it's about poor Algerian men who are sending home remittances to their families, and they suffer from these terrible physical pains, but they can't actually point to where it is they're really suffering. They just feel pain all over. And the French doctors had this habit of dismissing their symptoms as evidence of a so-called North African syndrome. They didn't want to work, or they were suffering from a kind of imaginary malady. In other words, they were either crazy or they were lazy. And Fanon, of course, developed a very different analysis that linked their symptoms to their status in France. He was onto something about the psychological nature of social suffering. And this is crucial to Soleil, which culminates in this scene of madness, hallucination, running
beyond
from the city.
Beyond language, kind of.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. The other thing that this film explores is just the intense effort made by the French to tell the colonized that really they're French. We see them being quote unquote educated as French subjects. And this is something, of course, that is at the center of Black Skin, White Masks. I mean, what is the white mask but something that the colonized has internalized so that they feel as if they're like any other white French person?
Yeah, I think also in a lot of Hondo's film, Soleil, but also West Indies, there is this rage against the comprador class, the bourgeois intellectuals who collaborate with the colonizers, which also strikes me as a kind of Fanonian position.
It's t- totally Fanonian. And of course, this is also a theme that reverberates in the films that we just talked about by African-American directors who had a loathing of the black middle class, the so-called black bourgeoisie that E. Franklin Frazier wrote about, and who identified instead with this supposedly kind of uncorrupted urban lumpen proletariat as a kind of repository of revolutionary energy. As it happens, Hondo never mentions Fanon in Soleil, but in a later film of his, very, very striking film, whose title I'm afraid I'm forgetting, about an Algerian woman who has been raped. Yes, Fatima. Thank you. In Fatima, Fatima is the story of an Algerian woman who has been raped by a black soldier, by a tirailleur sénégalais during the independence struggle. And she gives birth to a son who is both black and Algerian. And there's a photograph of Fanon in the living room. And the boy at some point asks whether this is his grandfather. It's an incredible scene.
Well, that reminds me another thing you mentioned in the book, this kind of Fanon's popularization, that actually there's a scene in White Lotus of this character reading Wretched of the Earth, which I had completely forgotten about until, I remember seeing it a few years ago. Then the fact that you you mentioned it in the book reminded me of this sort of, pop co-optation of Fanon as well.
Absolutely. And not just in White Lotus, but also in a film that I didn't mention because it seemed a little too obscure to me, but quite an interesting film. I guess I would describe it as an American style Michael Haneke film by a director who I believe is Nigerian American, Julius Ona. It's called Loose.
Yes, I never saw it, but I remember it doing the rounds, and it's about this adoptive.
Well, it's about this. Son. It's about this this adopted son, and he's the child of he's from a war zone that is never identified by name. He and we're told that he was a child soldier before he came to the States, and he's been adopted by Naomi Watts and Tim Roth. They're playing the kind of iconic, well-meaning, white liberal bourgeois couple. And they adopt him, and he's brilliant, he's charming, but he's also somewhat inscrutable. Hmm. You know, that he carries some, you know, energy within him, some, collective unconscious, some past that hasn't been mastered. I'm being somewhat facetious, but he ends up writing a paper about Fanon and about Fanon's defense of violence. And his teacher, played by Octavia Spencer, reports him to the authorities at the school, and suddenly it becomes this huge crisis. And the film turns around the enigma of his character. And has he merely written a paper defending violence? Is he violent himself? It's probably the most prominent use of Fanon that I've seen in a recent fiction film. And then, of course, there's Claire Denis. You know, Claire Denis is constantly alluding to Fanon.
Yeah, I mean, Claire Denis films like No Fear, No Die is, you know, famously Fanonian. But there was a film you mentioned when we were planning this podcast, The Passenger. I thought would be interesting to discuss, and I actually did. I had actually never seen The Passenger, and so I watched it in preparation for this conversation.
So do you understand now?
I totally understand. I mean, it's I'm glad that I actually watched it with this context.
Yeah.
Because I think it's kind of fantastically Fanonian, but approaches those questions so obliquely through this.
It does.
Question of through this American, this Western journalist, and his strange usurping of another man's identity, and the Fanonian questions somehow almost unfold in not the background, but certainly not the foreground either. You know,
it's not Antonioni's focus. It certainly isn't. Just as I don't think that the I don't think that the Fanonian dimension of Michael Haneke's cachet is the central aspect of that film, although I think arguably it's more important than it is in Antonioni's film. But I still wanted to include this because, you know, there's this remarkable scene in the film where Jack Nicholson, playing this revered reporter who has, you know, reported from various conflict zones, is in the Sahel somewhere. Is it Chad? Okay, it's Chad, and he goes to interview a rebel commander. Begins to ask him questions, and what the rebel commander does is he turns around the camera and begins to interview Jack Nicholson's character, and more or less says to Jack Nicholson, you know, you'll really never be able to understand what our struggle is about, and why are you here, to me, this is, you know, for one thing, it's a very Fanonian gesture to turn the tables on the Western spectator, the agent of an imperial country. But I think it goes deeper than that. I think that what Antonioni is trying to evoke here is the asymmetrical relations between the countries that do the reporting and the countries that are reported on.
Well, it's also the case that Antonioni himself had made a documentary about a revolutionary situation, like just shortly before this, right?
Oh, the documentary on China,
right?
Which the Chinese hated, by the way, but the sure, Chinese but, government hated.
But I think he was thinking about these issues probably as a result of that, and
he was.
It sent him into this existential spiral that we see Jack Nicholson.
Well, absolutely. I mean, this is like the period between, let's say, the mid 1960s, really the moment after Algerian decolonization and the Iranian Revolution, that's the peak moment where the Third World makes itself present in the consciousness of the West, and I think that's what you're seeing in Antonioni, which is so interesting because you know in previous Antonioni films, and I love Antonioni. And I'm thinking here of, I think it's, I'm not sure if it's the Eclipse or if it's L'Avventura. There are racially very troubling scenes of dancing Africans. I mean, it's clear that, you know, that for Antonioni, the black person is an exoticized other. In these films in the early 1960s. But by the time he makes The Passenger in the early 1970s, Africans have made themselves felt as actors in history. And Jack Nicholson is actually, as the reporter, is not in a position where he's calling the shots. I mean, we see that, for example, in the scene where he's taken to a meeting. And the boy who's really a boy, I think, who's leading him there, runs off.
And he feels
totally deserted. So we actually see something of the fear, you know, the fear of, you know, of the, you know, archetypal white man in a situation that he cannot control.
Yeah. I mean, there's also that scene where he's interviewing the rebel, and I believe that footage is watched later by his wife and his coworker or boss. And I don't remember it exactly, the dialogue, but there's this moment where that rebel soldier is underlining this like untranslatability of this conversation, where this reporter is asking questions, he's giving answers that the reporter is not satisfied with, and the rebel says something along the lines of, I have answers, they're not the ones you want, and so this conversation is a failure.
Thank you. Well, that's perfect, actually, because it evokes the total communication failure between these rebels and this, you know, this Western system of information that attempts to understand them but completely misses the point.
And it's such an analogy for, I think, psychiatry too, right? You know, this trying to, I mean, Fanon really struggled with using the language of French psychiatry.
Yeah, that's a very good point, because in the essay on the North African syndrome, for example, and not just that, in many of his psychiatric writings, he frequently writes about the abject failures of his own profession. You know, because remember, he had, you know, when he was in Algeria, he found himself running a psychiatric institution in Blida that had been founded by a man who was a psychiatric reformer, Antoine Poirot, but was also a scientific racist. And so, you know, much of Fanon's writing on psychiatry is also it's an internal critique of psychiatry from an anti-colonial perspective. So I think you're absolutely right. I think that's a really, really illuminating analogy. And what does the Jack Nicholson character end up doing once he exchanges identities with the man he meets at that hotel? He ends up becoming an arms trader and a gun runner for what appear to be pro-Western African forces.
Right. With a fake passport to boot.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating film. Jack Nicholson had an unusually intimate relationship to that film, and I believe that he owns it. And I think you'd have to look this up, but what I was told was that Nicholson wanted the rights to that film because he identified with the story regarding the confusion of identity, since he was apparently the son of his sister, and he spent many years not knowing that. So he had lived with this identity drama. You'd have to check this, but this is what I was told by someone.
Well, yeah, it's enough to be an actor, I think, right? And be like a celebrity. I'm sure he identified.
Probably. But I think that there was something, you know, more psychological in his relationship to the film. When I think about Fanon in cinema, though, I think probably the filmmaker who engaged most deeply with Fanon over the years was Usman Sembene. You know, Usman Sembene was a dock worker. He was a communist. He read Fanon starting in the 1950s. Black Girl is a very Fanonian film. I mean, when you think about the way that that mask changes in the film. At the very beginning, what is the mask? It's just a symbol of this woman's culture that she offers as a gift. Then she takes it back from her persecutors. And after she dies, after she's committed suicide, that mask is held up by this little boy in the village that she comes from. And that mask has acquired a different significance. That mask is a symbol of revolt and defiance. And it's very much like Fanon's treatment of the Hayek, of the veil, in his essay Algeria Unveiled, where he writes about how the veil changes in the course of an anti-colonial revolution. You have women who are wearing the veil. He calls it a kind of a dead article of a culture, right? In some ways it's a symbol of the hold of patriarchy. Then the women who become involved in the struggle remove the veil and go out to fight. But then later, in a later stage of the struggle, they reassume the veil. But when they reassume it, it no longer has the same meaning. It's now become a symbol of resistance to the French. So in a sense, the veil by that point is like the mask in Usman Sembene. And then later, Sembene goes on to make films that are scathing in their depiction of the national bourgeoisie, of the ruling elite, and of what you call the comprador class, or for that matter, I mean, I think another profound example in Sembene's films is his film about female circumcision. You know, I mean, Fanon was someone. Let's remember, Fanon was someone who was someone who appreciated Algerian medicine, but he also was a Western doctor who was very critical of culture, of, you know, of practices that imprison people in some way. So
Moulade,
I think
is the one you're
Moulage, Moulage. So I think that Sembene, in a sense, was the perhaps the most faithful in his reading and practice of you know, of Fanon.
Well, I have to say one thing that I've learned from this discussion is that it's less about like what film is a Fanonian and more about like how we can read films through kind of a Fanonian perspective. And I think, as you've said, much like Marx, we can bring these readings to films and understand, discover things about the not only the intents of the filmmakers, but the unintended meanings that the films have.
Yes, and I do want to say one last thing, because I feel terribly remiss at not having mentioned this. Fanon is a very visual writer. You know, the Black Skin, White Mask, Wretched of the Earth has this incredibly startling image of the colonial city that is divided into two between the European city and the city, you know, the Kasbah, the city where the Algerian masses live. That is an image that you find directly lifted in the Battle of Algiers. It's almost as if Pontecorvo read The Wretched of the Earth, read A Dying Colonialism, and wrote scenes on the basis of Fanon's prose. The scene where those three women, Zora Dreef, Samaria Lakhdaria, and Jamila Buhared, go out to plant bombs, that scene could have been taken from the essay Algeria Unveiled. So there is, I think, a really strong visual element of Fanon that gets transposed into works of cinema made by people who read him.
Reading the book and thinking about Fanon for this discussion really left me feeling melancholy that he didn't live to see the rise of African filmmaking and so many anti-colonial filmmakers who really brought his ideas to very vivid life. What if he had seen Med Honda? What if he had seen, you know, Usman Sembene's films?
Yeah, what if we'd had a kind of a panel with Sarah Maldoror, another person who I think Absolutely. Is very Fanonian, and she really deserves mention.
I was actually thinking, we didn't have time, but Monangambe, her short film, is such a Fanonian film to me. In the way that it's like, it's about Angola and the Angolan freedom struggle, filmed in Algeria, about the breakdown of communication. There's just so many directions we could go.
She's incredible. But if you had Sarah Maldoror, Med Hondo, Gillo Pontecorvo, Usman Sembene, and Fanon sitting around on TV talking about African cinema, that would have been worth seeing.
Instead, it's just us on a podcast.
I know. Instead, it's Clint, Devika, and Adam.
I think this is a good idea for a future podcast. We'll have to have you back on to talk about Sarah Maldoror and any number of other fascinating subjects. Thank you so much, Adam, for joining us to talk about your new book, The Rebels Clinic.
Available to order or purchase at, Adam, you want to do a little plug?
Really, any platform, I think. On Amazon.
The internet.
Oh, no.
Don't say Amazon. At your local indie bookstore.
Buy it at a good bookstore. Yes, buy it at a good bookstore, please.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll put links to films and a link to the book in the description. And yeah, thank you so much.
The Film Comment podcast features original music by Greg Einge. Film Comment is a publication of Film at Lincoln Center. Since 1962, Film Comment has been the home of independent film journalism, publishing in-depth interviews, critical analysis, and feature coverage of mainstream, arthouse, and avant-garde filmmaking from around the world. Visit us online at filmcomment.com.